You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Edward Curtis was a successful and talented photographer in Seattle at the turn of the 20th century, known for the artistry of his portraiture, and he was constantly in demand. A series of serendipitous events sparked an interest in taking pictures of Indians, and Curtis spent the next 30 years obsessed with making a record of the Indian tribes and their way of life before it disappeared forever. Timothy Egan tells his story in his new book, Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today.
Great to be with you, Len.
What tribe originally lived in the area we call Seattle?
What tribes did?
Yeah.
The Duwamish and the Suquamish, people who lived off the sea and largely sedentary, built these big longhouses, but small in population.
And then they were forced to leave?
Well, they signed a treaty very quickly. There was a minor skirmish. They signed a treaty, and each native got the equivalent of 4 blankets and $25 to give up what became most of the inland Pacific Northwest, all of Puget Sound.
But a woman, Angeline, was allowed to stay in Seattle.
Yeah, here's the great irony. Seattle is the biggest city in the world named for a Native American, yet at the time they'd passed a law making it illegal for an Indian to live within the city limits, except for Angeline. They sort of took pity on her. She's the last surviving daughter of Chief Seattle. So they kept her around as sort of this object of pity, and it sort of validated their belief that one way of life was erasing another.
Well, this city had been named after her father, so
right.
That was another reason. And Curtis felt moved to take her picture?
He did. He was somewhat of a dandy at the time, good-looking guy, on the rise, very prosperous already. In fact, eventually he would be signed up by Teddy Roosevelt to shoot the wedding of his daughter, Alice. He was sort of an Annie Leibovitz of his day. But he saw a moment sort of vanishing in the picture of Angeline against Puget Sound. And that sort of was one of the things that launched him on this epic, what became his 30-year journey.
How did he wind up in the Northwest? His father had been a chaplain in the Union Army.
His father was a sickly Civil War chaplain. The farm was failing in the Midwest, and they moved to the Puget Sound country and homesteaded. The day the mother arrived, the old man died. So Curtis basically raised his widowed mother and 3 children.
Mm-hmm. And he had a brother. They both became photographers.
His brother was equally famous in the West, took more than 40,000 photographs in their own right, but they didn't speak to each other for the last 40 years of their lives.
And the reason was that there was an article about them, or they wrote it together?
No, there was a dispute over property, over the Alaska Gold Rush, and Curtis claimed that the younger brother, that he, Curtis, owned the copyright because the younger brother was working for him, and the younger brother said, hey, I took the pictures. Mm-hmm. And so they never spoke again, even at their mother's funeral.
Were they self-taught photographers?
They were. They were self-taught. What's interesting about them was that Curtis had a 6th-grade education. He dropped out of school after 6th grade. And at the height of his fame, when his book was being compared to the largest undertaking since the King James Bible and being compared to the John James Audubon's books, Birds of America, among the greatest achievements in all of bookmaking, the New York, Stieglitz and those types were praising him for being the avant-garde, for pushing the edge of photography. And he probably didn't know half of what they were talking about. He understood light. He understood faces.
He took incredible photographs. He obviously was talented.
That's the great legacy, Leonard. And what I found, I went to most of the Indian homelands that Curtis went to, and the Curtis pictures were everywhere in Indian country because people point to these things and they say, there's a human being in that face, not a character type.
And some of the photos have become almost iconic. For example, his photograph of Chief Joseph is the one that we always see when Chief Joseph is written about.
Or Geronimo, who, interesting.
He did that famous Geronimo photo.
Geronimo shows up for Teddy Roosevelt's inauguration in 1904, and they give him a headdress and parade him down Pennsylvania Avenue. Later that day, Curtis poses him in a simple army blanket because that's what the U.S. Army gave Geronimo when he surrendered.
So Curtis has a successful career doing portraits in Seattle.
Right. And all over the West by that point, too.
And he also likes to do a few nude studies, which probably were considered a little racy at the time.
Exactly.
And then what happens? How does he become...
He gets bored with shooting the debutantes and the society matrons, and he goes up to... he also was a mountaineer, too. He's endlessly curious and restless and has incredible energy. I call it short nights because he never sleeps more than a few hours. He's up on Mount Rainier, this 14,000-foot volcano, where he rescues 2 of the most famous men in America. One of them is Bird Grinnell, the founder of the National Audubon Society. Grinnell becomes his mentor. Grinnell knows more about Plains Indians than any other living American. He even had an Indian name. He speaks the language. So he sort of introduces Curtis to, look, there's not just these stragglers living down in the streets, but there are these intact communities.
And the other one was Clinton Merriman, the founder of the National Geographic Society.
Yes. So, pretty serendipitous for two guys to rescue on a mountaintop.
And at this time, Ed is taking pictures that we now think of as the kind of Ansel Adams photograph.
Exactly. And Ansel Adams studied Curtis, particularly later in his Southwest pictures. That when Ansel Adams goes to the Southwest and shoots these monolithic pictures, same with John Ford when he shoots his westerns out of Monument Valley, they're entirely echoes of what Curtis had done 30 years earlier.
By the way, we have a slideshow of some of Edward Curtis's photographs on our show page at WNYC.org if you want to know what we're talking about. So he meets these two important men in the environmentalist movement, early, the John Muir types.
Right.
And they convert him? They change his way of seeing things?
I wouldn't call them environmentalists. That word hadn't come around. But they are interested in preserving the America that is being erased. You know, so that's what leads to the National Parks Movement, National Land Preservation. And nothing more original about America is being erased faster than the people who've lived here for thousands of years. The census finds 235,000 of them.
Well, they take this trip on a boat up to Alaska, a boat called the Elder. And you say it was kind of a floating university for Curtis.
Well, John Muir was on it. Gifford Pinchot, the founder of the Forest Service, on it. John Muir. It was E.H. Harriman funding it. But Curtis was appalled at what they did. These people pillaged and plundered different native villages, took totem poles and masts and things that are now worth, in some cases, millions of dollars, because they thought these villages were, you know, empty. The people were out hunting. It was their right to take it. And he was appalled by that. So when he finally started his expedition, his odyssey, the greatest photographic odyssey in American history, by the way, more than Matthew Brady, he says, I will pay my subjects. I will never take a subject's picture without asking their permission.
But he actually is engaged in a debate that we still have today. Were the Elgin marbles saved because the British put it in the British Museum, or should they be back in Athens? These guys felt that they were saving these artifacts from the Native Americans because it was a changing way of life.
I mean,
and Curtis said, no, wait a minute. These are traditions that should be sustained.
That's exactly right. Very well put. I don't need to add to that.
So how did the Indians feel about having their pictures taken?
Initially, they opposed Curtis. They threw dirt on his camera. They chased him. They reported him to the Indian agents. But it's important to understand what was going on at the time. Indians were being plucked out of their homelands and put into these boarding schools where they were basically erasing their culture. They clipped their hair. They put them in tight shoes, and they taught them Christianity. Once they washed the Indian out of them, which is the term these boarding schools use, they would put them back into the reservations.
They outlawed their ceremonies, didn't they?
Well, that's what's astonishing. We revere the First Amendment in this country because it allows each of us to worship the God of our choice with one asterisk, Leonard. Unless you're Native American, you couldn't worship the God of your choice. It was a felony to have the Sun Dance in the Blackfeet Nation in Montana. It was a felony to have the snake dance ritual for the Hopi. And that's what Curtis is after. He's essentially an accomplice to a crime.
So he starts moving past the Northwest. He winds up going to Montana to the Piegan Blackfoot settlement.
Right.
In hopes of discovering a disappearing culture?
Right. He wants to see intact communities. I mean, he's used to these straggler Indians roaming around the edges of Seattle. And Bird Grinnell shows him an entire community, young people, old people, having their sun dance in the high plains of Montana.
Now, his name is Bird Grinnell, and he's with the Audubon Society. Was that a name that was given to him, or was
Given to him by the native people because he would arrive in the summer, stay all summer, and then disappear in the fall.
Now, Grinnell, you say, was both mentor and tormentor to Curtis.
Right. Mentor in that he encouraged him in this great idea that it became. Tormentor in that he criticized a lot of his early methods.
And then, but without Grinnell, he might not have had the access to some of these tribes.
Exactly. Grinnell was the entree point. Grinnell spoke the language and was an honorary member of the Pawnee as well.
What happened when Curtis wanted to photograph ritual dances like the Sundance of the Piegan tribe?
Well, there was resistance. There was quite a bit of resistance because, as I said, they were crimes, and the native people resisted him too. It took him more than 10 years, Leonard, to get took deep into the Hopi Nation to photograph their snake dance. And he became, not in the Kevin Costner sense of playing Indian, but he became an honorary member of the Snake Dance Society. He was actually a snake dance priest, and that allowed him to get some of those stunning pictures of those photos of those snake dance members.
And he participated in the ceremony.
Exactly.
Now, when did he start being called Shadow Catcher?
That happened in Arizona Territory, and it was the Navajo that gave him that name. He had two nicknames. One was the man who sleeps on his breath, because he always had carried this air mattress, mm-hmm. and they thought that was interesting. And kind of a long nickname, so he'd be the Shadow Catcher, because he used all natural light. Curtis pictures were never shot with artificial light. He always was manipulating, the tent flap, where he would allow different kinds of light in at the day to take his portraits.
My guest is Timothy Egan, who won the National Book Award for a very different kind of book than the one we are discussing, Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, The Epic Life and Immortal Photographs of Edward Curtis. How did you go from we know you best to writing this sort of thing?
Well, I've written a lot about the original places, the places I love in the West, and I finally thought it was time to write about the original inhabitants. And I was fascinated by this character. The arc of his life mimics the arc of great artists, because I don't want to step on the punchline, but it ends in tragedy. It ends like F. Scott Fitzgerald, who dies alone thinking he's a hack and no one will ever read The Great Gatsby. Great Gatsby sold less than 40,000 copies. Curtis loses everything. He creates this masterpiece compared to the greatest books of all time, and he loses his copyright, loses all his money, loses his family, is alone in a crappy little apartment in Beverly Hills at age 82, corresponding with a librarian trying to relay some of the impact of what he's done.
Now, in Beverly Hills, because he also made a film?
Right. After his wife and he divorced, she got all the property.
She divorced him because he had given up the lucrative career.
And was never home. Never home. He was gone 300-plus days a year. Although, interestingly, the children ended up siding with him. He, at one point after the divorce, this is really sad, went over and smashed a bunch of the glass plate negatives. He shot all his pictures on 14-by-17-inch glass plates, which are so valuable now. I mean, you see people getting up to $250,000 for, like, a copper print of a Curtis. But he was bitter. And he goes to Hollywood and gets some bit work shooting stills for Westerns, which he just hated.
But how did he fall in so far? As you said, he photographed Teddy Roosevelt's family. He gained access to J. Pierpont Morgan. He was riding pretty high.
In fact, the picture he took of Roosevelt said it was the best picture anyone ever took of him, and used it in his autobiography as the frontispiece. Here's what happened to him, Leonard. He made a perhaps fatal mistake of having J.P. Morgan, then the richest banker in America, then the equivalent of our Federal Reserve Board, as his benefactor. And he got deeper and deeper and deeper into the House of Morgan until they were $2.5 million. Because remember, Curtis had up to 30 people on his staff, translators, people in the lab, all this. So the deeper he got into House of Morgan, the more they asked, until at one point they owned the copyright. And so that took away his masterpiece. The other thing was, he was a pioneer filmmaker as well. He made a terrific film, now hailed in the Library of Congress as one of the most rebel. He hand-colored these frames. He used an all-native cast, shot entirely on location in 1913. No one had ever done this. But he lost a ton of money on that. He was the world's worst businessman.
He changed the perception of Colonel Custer and what happened at the Battle of Little Bighorn.
That's one of the many unknown stories about him. Now the accepted story of what happened to Custer. I'm glad you called him Colonel, by the way. You're one of the few people who knew he lost his generalship. Credit to you for knowing that. But Curtis spent 3 years deciphering the Custer story with survivors from both sides, the Crow Indians who supported Custer, the Cheyenne and the Sioux who were on the victorious side.
He also had an assistant who was an Indian?
Yes, and a very, very dear friend of his, a, quote, educated Indian. Remember, they were taking Indians out of their reservations. They put him in the Carlisle Indian School, and they sent him back after 12 years, and he was, quote, educated, but he was conflicted his entire life. And this guy, his name was Upshaw, Alexander Upshaw, was a Crow Indian, full blood. When Curtis asked him how he wanted to have be pictured in his photograph, he chose to take his shirt off and put on a headdress of his father, even though he had short hair, and to wear the beads and not wear the white man's garments, which he'd worn since he was educated. He dies, he's murdered, essentially, his best native friend.
Well, he went to Carlisle, which is where Jim Thorpe also went. Right. And you tell a story of Chief Joseph at a football game in Seattle. Not exactly the sort of thing I would have expected to hear.
No, and Joseph was the Indian Napoleon at the time, probably the best-known Native American outside of Geronimo. They haul him around Seattle at a football game. They asked him, 1903, University of Washington football game, they asked him what he thought, and he said through a translator, "I saw a lot of white men almost fight each other today."
Now, the movie was the first narrative documentary film?
Yes, because they used to do what were called I think they were called fact pictures, but they were only 5 to 10 minutes long. You had to string together 6 reels to get more than an hour of film.
So he created the first feature documentary?
Yes, and he's credited with that now. When Nanook of the North came out, that got all the breakthrough credit, but that was an entire ripoff of Curtis.
Well, it's a pretty great film in its own right, but Curtis was the first to do it. Did he change anything for the Indians?
You mean in...
Because there were attitudes. For example, he worked with Teddy Roosevelt, who a bit of a racist when it came to talking about
Indians.
That's
a very blunt term, but I think you're right. Roosevelt, in his books on the West, treated Indians terribly. Roosevelt was interested in saving land, but I think Curtis was one of the people who talked him into saying there's more than the land involved, there are the people as well. So by the time he writes the introduction for Curtis, he's come around a little bit to that. The other important thing to know about how he changed things, Indians weren't citizens until 1934. And Curtis was very active in his old age in the trying to get what became the Indian Citizens Act. So he did advocate on their behalf that resulted in part with their becoming full citizens.
Just one more thing about the Indians. Initially, you say they resisted being filmed. Did they come to realize that a disappearing way of life was being preserved by this man?
Yes. I'm sorry, I didn't finish the story. That's entirely what happened, because after a while, people would write him and solicit him. He was so backed up because they said, "We want you to come to our tribe. We want you to come." He traveled with his portfolio. So he would shoot some pictures, say, one year and then come back the next, and they loved what he was doing. So as his reputation grew, it went from resistance to him to actively soliciting him.
And a reminder, we have a slideshow of some of Edward Curtis's photographs on our show page at WNYC.org. Timothy Egan is a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer for the New York Times, best-selling author of 6 books. In 2006, he won the National Book Award for The Worst Hard Time. His latest, Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, The Epic Life and Immortal Photographs of Edward Curtis. And we're pleased that you include a fair number of them in this book, all fabulous photographs. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.